600 years. Well, welcome to this session on Namibia. I wasn't sure if anyone would come. We have seen with the independence of Namibia a certain tendency for folks to say, well, that issue is solved and we can check that off our list. So I'm glad to see you here. I wanted to read just something written by Randolph Vigna, a historian, who writes, "It is fated that Hainbili will die, and his successors likewise will perish. It is the strangers who will come in our country. Thus full Maharero and Vitboy and their successors perished in defeat also, as did other rulers of the old Namibia. So the strangers came to occupy Namibia and to rule it until on 21st of March 1990, the Namibians themselves returned to power in their own country." Now this seer at the court of Hainbili, a ruler in the north of Namibia and in Angola, foresaw that the coming of the Europeans would mean perhaps centuries of oppression and occupation for the people. Now, the session this morning is intended to be an introduction to the country of Namibia and a little lesson in a history lesson here from a history lesson about a country that very few people know much about. Namibia has not been on the front pages of the world press, certainly not in this country. It is really true that it is mainly the Lutherans in this country who have been learning about Namibia for the last couple decades. But for most people, Namibia is a mystery. We've had people ask us, I mean, people in official government offices when we call about some question have asked us, what do the letters stand for? They're assuming that Namibia is not a real place. I hope I'm not tied to this, because I want to use the map at least initially here.
I don't think it's working yet.
No, we can hear you quite well.
Yeah, so I think they're recording
it.
It's for recording. I think it'll probably be good.
I hope so. Okay. This is a map of the country of Namibia. And as you'll see, it's bordered on the north by Angola and Zambia, on the east by Botswana, the Kalahari Desert, and then its southern border is the Orange River. It borders with South Africa, and then, of course, the ocean to the west. Namibia is a very large country, about twice the size of California. It's a country with relatively small population, only perhaps 1.5 million people in Namibia. Of these, fewer than 1 in 10 is a white person. So most of Namibia is black Namibia. Namibia is largely an arid country. It's only the central highlands that are good for grazing cattle. And along the northern boundary, there is farmland. That's the only rivers in Namibia that are year-round rivers are the Kunene and the Kavango River in the north, and then the Orange River in the south. And one reason that Namibia's geography is important, I feel, is that it was the geography, the remoteness of Namibia that protected it from European colonization for almost 100 years after other parts of Africa had been colonized by European powers. These borders provide a real hindrance to other people. For example, the Namib Desert. And Namib is, in some languages, the shield. And the name, the Namib Desert runs about 50 miles deep and just about the entire coastland there. Then on the east you have the Kalahari, which and the Ovango-Kavango swampland up in the north, which is relatively inaccessible. Then the southern border, those are some of the most wild stretches of the Orange River. So the first people who came down the coast, Portuguese in the 1400s, took one look at Namibia and decided it was a worthless piece of the world. They described the first recorded landing we have was in 1485, and it was here near Swakopmund. And the Portuguese did not remain. They continued onward. Then the very next year, when the Portuguese explorer Diaz sailed down around the Cape of Good Hope, he stopped briefly here in Namibia, erected a stone cross, and delivered the opinion that the country was worthless, and sailed on. So it wasn't, Namibia was not colonized until long after some of the other African territories had been invaded. But in the late 1700s and early 1800s, the white presence down here in South Africa, around the Cape, around what is now Cape Town, slowly brought pressure on the Namibian people, or the people, the San people, who had little communities throughout the whole Southern Africa region, slowly were forced northward. And looked at the title of this, the first Namibia, the first 100 years, how provincial that title is, because of course Namibia was there long before. I'm talking about the first 100 years of white presence in Namibia. It clearly was not the first 100 years of black presence. Around 1800, maybe we should look at who was there in Namibia. And the original folks were the San people. We have called them Bushmen. And I think that presents for us a picture of who they were and what their life was like. Small clans, very nomadic, tremendous hunters. Probably some of you have seen The Gods Must Be Crazy, a movie which I have not seen for a variety of reasons. But it was the San, the nomadic hunters that were in this territory first. And they're called the Ancient Ones in a number of the languages of Namibia. The San people are referred to as the Ancient Ones. They seemed to be on the north in the Namib Desert, in the Kalahari Desert, always in real arid desert-like areas. There were other groups of people there in the early 1800s when the white presence began to be felt. The Herero peoples were in the central, and these were a different, the San people tend to be short. The Herero were more a Bantu stature, taller. They did cattle raising in this area, right in the central highlands of the country. Their community life was a little more structured, really, than the San, who, being nomadic, were really, it was a family, a very rich interpersonal family relationships for the San. The Herero, there was community organization. Then there were also the Nama people and Damara people. They were present in the northeast, interestingly, but also mainly in this area. And they were people that felt the push of white presence in South Africa. They were, again, goat and sheep herders. Some cattle, but they did not, they were not agriculturally oriented. There was some hunting. They lived in groups of five or six clans, maybe 1,000 people. And so you see that there had to be then community organizations and relationships. The men did the cattle herding and the hunting. The women did the cultivating and provided for shelter. Then there came to be in this area a number of people called the Basters. They were of mixed racial, resulting from mixed racial alliances in the Cape area. And they moved north and formed, how do we say that, Jim? Rehoboth?
Yeah.
It was a political entity that exists even to this day as somewhat separate from the rest of Namibia. And then in the far north were the Ovambo peoples. And this is the one place where there was year-round agriculture. The communities were settled and well-organized. And they also did copper and iron smelting and traded both north and with their neighbors within Namibia. So it wasn't that when the Europeans came, they came into an empty territory. There were all these various groups that were aware of each other, groups that interacted in trading, occasionally had turf battles, especially between the Nama and the Herero in terms of pasture land for the cattle. But that was basically the situation in the early 1800s. One of the negative features of the pressure north and the fact that a few white settlers came in those first 1800s, very few, but they brought with them guns, which was the beginning of the transformation of Namibian life. Now, in the 1840s, German missionaries came to Namibia. It was the Rhenish Mission Society that began work in Namibia at that time. Now, I've met a man who says his parents, his ancestors were the very first, and they came and settled down here at Varmbad. There was a group of people called Orlams, who were a Christian group of Nama folk. And his story is that some of these folks had stolen cattle down below in South Africa and fled across the Orange River and settled. And then, being Christian, they asked the folks down south to please send them missionaries. And the folks down there said, forget you, basically. What you did was wrong. The reason you're there is wrong. We will not send pastors to you. And so that, according to him, is when the call went to the German mission societies to send pastors to the people. And so it was in about the 1840s, 1840-1842, that German missionaries arrived in Namibia. They arrived in and began work in the central part of the country. It's real sobering for those of us who are Christian to realize that that was in many ways the beginning of the century of occupation, oppression, and persecution, because it was the same people bringing the message of the gospel who also were the first to drive the Namibian people from their land, rob them of their cattle, and persecute any of them who resisted. So the Rhenish missionaries in 1864, they were settled out where the United Lutheran Seminary exists, out in this area. They asked for help, for protection from the Prussian government, and that was the beginning of German military presence in Namibia. And closely following the missionaries were merchants, German merchants. In 1882, a man by the name of Luderitz came looking, he said, for copper, but it also certainly hoping to find gold and diamonds, because he was aware of the discoveries in South Africa. And he, through devious means, bought, theoretically, large portion of Namibia here along the coast. You know, right from the beginning, the attitude of the occupiers was real clear. 'Cause he said, one of the things he said back in 1880 was, we aim to leave this country a gaping hole. I mean, he knew of the riches, the mineral, well, he suspected the mineral riches, and was moving in to exploit them. And one of the other things that he did was he dealt with some of the local chiefs in the area, the Nama chiefs, and bought the land from them. But he paid for it in rifles, in the old rifles, old guns, and he cheated them in that they thought he was talking about geographical miles when they sold their land, and or they thought he was talking about English miles, and in reality he was talking, according to him, geographical miles. So he got five times the territory, and in spite of continued protests to the German government, that was never rectified. So the first presence, the impact of Germany on Namibia was very, very negative. It was during the latter part of the 1800s, the 19th century, that the European nations decided we need to bring some order to this. Now, they were all claiming territory in Africa. So in 1884, there was a conference in Berlin, and Africa was really divided up among the colonizing nations of Europe. Namibia, with the exception of this little area around Walvis Bay, was given to the Germans. And some people ask, why is this strange formation? Well, first of all, I think in your presentation, Jim, you had talked about the fact that when the lines of the nations in Africa were drawn back there in 1884, there was very little attention paid to the ethnic groups that lived there. So the northern boundary of Namibia cuts right through the Kwanyama, right through a whole group of people that part of them became Portuguese Angolans and part of them became German Southwest African folks. But the reason this stretches out this way is that Germany also claimed the area, they called it Tanganyika, on the eastern coast. And they looked at these rivers up here and thought, well, maybe there is a water route that would link their two possessions. So they claimed what is called the Caprivi Strip, going way out there. Unfortunately for them, I guess, was you go out and you run into Victoria Falls, which makes navigation, at least from one direction, real difficult. So, but this has existed then in this funny way ever since then. The German occupation time for Namibians was extremely difficult. They wasted no time in, as I said, driving the Namibians from their land and subjugating them in every way possible. From time to time, if there was a hint of Namibian resistance, as in 1892, from some of the Nama people here, the German military force would just move in and settle matters, killing as many people as necessary. In 1904, so at the beginning then of this century, the Herero people, who at that time were the largest population group and they were in the center here, they began an uprising to drive the German people out. The chief Maharero wrote to his friend, the chief of the Namas, a Witboy, and said, "It is clear that the Germans are here not for our benefit. They continually kill people for no reason at all," he wrote, "and won't you join me in driving them out?" Well, that letter never was delivered. It was intercepted before Chief Witboy received it. So the Hereros really went it alone against the Germans. Their uprising began, it's called an uprising, in January of 1904. And it was a completely unequal battle in terms of weapons. In August of that year, the final significant battle or massacre, whatever you want to call it, took place. So the Hereros were defeated by August. But then a German general by the name of von Trotta issued an extermination order, ordering that all Hereros, armed or unarmed, men, women, or children, should be shot. And then further, I was looking around in the stacks at the Minneapolis Library a few years ago and found translations of what went between Namibia and the German government, the parliament, the Reichstag in those days. And this chilling quote about how, from this von Trotta, that the stragglers, the remainders, should be driven eastward, ever eastward, so that nature may complete what the German army has begun. In other words, the complete extermination of the Herero nation. And they very nearly succeeded. It's estimated that there were 80,000 Hereros at the beginning of 1904. And of these, possibly 10,000 survived. Of those, most of them were in German concentration camps. Great, great numbers died in the Kalahari. And the description of von Trotta sending his troops out to check then the next spring what had happened, you know, and the description of finding huge holes in the desert sand that people had dug by hand trying to find water, and then the bodies around. Just an incredible genocide for the Herero people. The Nama people, having not received the word that this was to be a united effort, began fighting later that year, virtually after the war was over. And they struggled on for a couple of years. They lost 35% to 40% of their population. It was just a real ruthless extermination of any kind of resistance. And I always wonder how it is that Namibia exists today as certainly one of the most Christian nations in the world. 90% of the people Christian, probably 55% of them Lutheran. When their introduction to Christianity was a fearsome one. It must say something to the strength, the power of the gospel. The other factor that I think explains the deep, deep religious faith and certainly the strong Lutheran tradition in Namibia was that in about 1860, 1870, this German Mission Society, a Pastor Hahn, who was one of the early founders of it, went way north and discovered all kinds of people living in the north, people who had not been touched because of the isolation, who had not realized were there. And he sent word to the Finnish Mission Society, and they began work there in the north of Namibia in the late 1860s, early 1870s. And while the Finnish missionaries, also to a limited extent, or to a certain extent, imposed their culture on the people, clearly it was a very different relationship. And their record for caring for the needs of the Namibian people is certainly an admirable one. One that when you compare it to other colonizing efforts in different parts of the world, it is a clear example as to what it might have been. Now, it certainly was not my friend, a Namibian woman who grew up in the north. Selma Sheavali says, you know, the missionaries made us take off all our necklaces. They would not let us dance. They would, and then 30 years later, they began to wear necklaces. And she said, we had to be allowed to do again what had been ours. But in 1906,
so what was the time frame of this in terms of the war that was going on by the South?
Well, the Finnish work began in the 1860s, and the war in the South didn't happen until 1904. But the North was really separate. They were not affected very much by the German occupation, at least this, as far as I can tell. And in fact, some of the Hereros who managed to escape the massacre during the war fled to the north. And that was kind of an area apart. So it was really two developments in one. How did they travel there? I don't know. I don't know whether they, I would guess they probably came in here and then went north, but I don't know that. So, welcome. Well, a couple of things, though, that did affect the north was the discovery of gold, or of this area. Old Luderitz was right. Under these desert sands, I should say Namibia is one of the richest nations in Africa because there are diamonds, there's copper in the north around Sumeb, there's the largest open pit uranium mine in the world. They have discovered oil offshore and now are suspecting there is internally. There is the richest, or was the richest, fishing industry in Africa. Offshore here. It's been vastly overfished by South Africa and the multinationals, but it is there, and I'm interested to see the efforts that are right now being put into somehow getting control of it to protect it and rebuild it. So in terms of resources, it's a tremendously... Luderitz was right. Tremendously rich country. But there were not enough people to work the mines, either the copper mines or way down here the diamond mines. And so there came to be great pressure in the early decades of this country, great pressure on the black Namibian men to leave their homes and families. See, they'd wiped out most of the Hereros, so it was now, and continues to this day, that the Ovambo are the largest population group because basically they survived those terrible years. So there began to be great pressure on black Namibians to come as contract laborers in the industries in the South, and that has had, over the years, a real damaging impact on family life, on community structures, and so forth. Okay, that, please interrupt me. Yes.
When the few Hereros, did you say that went north, was there any difficulty then with the groups that were already living?
No,
there?
They were given refuge by one of the Ndonga. Yeah, no, as I read it, they were given refuge then in the north. Apparently one particular group, Ndonga leader, welcomed them in. So there had been, you know, before it, I think it's a danger to present a picture of an ideal no-conflict societies before the arrival of the white people. But it certainly there were instances of land disputes because land was so important. But there was not the idea of land ownership. You used the land responsibly, but it didn't belong to you. And so there were conflicts, but not anywhere in the scope of what came as a result of white incursions.
I have a question.
Sure.
Did the missionaries offer any resistance to the actions of the...
You know, I'm sure individual missionaries who did. But it's a real serious thing for me. I know in the last few years, as Namibian pastors and scholars have come out, you know, well-educated folks. We had a couple at Wartburg Seminary who wanted to do a history of the church. And then a man named Peter Kachavivi. I have some books on the back there that I have a few for sale. But Peter Kachavivi, one of the leading historians of Namibia, was writing one of his books on resistance, and another is on the church and whatever, wanted to do research in the archives of the Rhenish Missionary Society, and they sealed the archives. The history of the early German presence there was pretty negative.
Who sealed the archives?
The Mission Society did, so that it could not be read exactly the role that they had played.
Well, who has control over the Mission Society? I mean, why would they have that kind of autonomy that they could just close them?
Well, they're their records. I mean, the records belong to them.
Oh.
And so they closed them.
Huh.
Certainly there had to be, and certainly I know there were, individual examples. But there is a great deal of anger, or used to be at least, on the part of some of our Namibian friends over, well, quotes. There was a German missionary who talked about the education. There is no need for an educated Namibian. We must, black Namibian, we must train them to be obedient. Or another early church, well, not too early, in this century, church leader who said, the day that a black Namibian is ordained as a Lutheran, I will take off my robes. So it was not a good picture. But
this missionary society that did seal the archives was the German missionary society?
Yeah. These were the records, the letters that came back and forth from Namibia to Germany during this whole period. So, okay, then came the First World War, and South Africa, at the request of Great Britain, invaded Namibia, because this was a German colony, right? And they came in through Walvis, and in 1915, and worked their way in and captured, took control of the capital. And many, many black Namibians fought with the South Africans, believing this was their liberation. Whether that was a deliberate attempt to deceive them, I don't know. But the South Africans clearly pictured themselves as the liberators of Namibia. And there is a blue book which was produced about that time that detailed the German atrocities against black Namibians. And South Africa very self-righteously portrayed itself as coming to rescue the Namibians. But in 1915, while the South Africans were taking control here, up in Angola, remember this thing that I read in the beginning about the Kwanyama, the court of Haimbili and Kwanyama? This was a group that was over Angola and northern Namibia. They were having a battle with Angola, with the Portuguese. One of the great leaders of the Kwanyama people, this chief Mandume, and I don't know if I ruin his name, had fought against the Portuguese in Angola and then come down into Namibia. And in 1915, the South Africans, after securing the country here, moved north and together with the Portuguese defeated him and executed him and brought his head to Windhoek as a symbol that the entire region has now been pacified, I guess would be the word, that now there was European control over that whole area. The South Africans, while they initially presented themselves as the liberators, wasted no time in adopting the German practices and carrying them much further. It was in 1920, after the war, after the First World War, in Geneva, Switzerland, Germany's colonies were officially parceled out, and South Africa, which was then the part of the British Empire, South Africa received Namibia as a sacred trust, promising to care for the welfare of Namibians and to prepare them for independence. That was in 1920 that this was signed. And already by 1923, South Africa had reserved for itself 95% of the land. They just, the reservation system was just really geared up, so that 90% of the people in Namibia were relegated, only 5% of the land. They passed a law, I believe that was even in 1920, that no black Namibian, it was illegal for a black Namibian to be without visible means of support. He had to be working for the white person, or he could be arrested. No one could wander about idly. I mean, we were going to get our money's worth here out of the folks. And by 1926, the white population had doubled as the farmland increasingly had been transferred from the black Namibians to whites. A number of the white folks from Angola, in fact, also came down and were given rich, I mean, where there's water in Namibia, that was an old Namibian saying, where there's water, it's white man's land. The Namibians were relegated to the absolute most barren areas of the country. Yes?
What about under German domination? Had the Germans also controlled most of the land?
They had definitely, yeah. They
and then they lost it to,
yeah,
the,
right.
To South Africans,
yeah.
And Angolans now?
Yeah. They had started the process of occupying the land and designating certain areas that black Namibians could, where they could live. Now, I saw once that their idea of calling it the reserves came from what they had heard about the United States and reservations. I've not been able to trace this thing back, but that they had heard of this wonderful idea, because the time is, you know, fairly concurrent there. This wonderful idea of how to deal with a population. It's called reservations. And so...
Did they place all the people on these reserves, or did they actually have them in the white population so that they could be using them as work resources?
What developed in the early 1920s became really formalized with contract labor organizations, but was that the families had to live. I wonder if I guess I don't have. The families had to live on the reservations in the north, or the Hereros, ironically, were assigned a part of the desert where so many people had died in the massacre. It was, I don't know whether it was a sense of humor or what, but the families had to live in these arid, barren places. And then initially it was the men who came down to work in the mines, to work in the industries. And it was a form of contract labor where a metal bracelet was put on the wrist with a date. And the Namibians literally could be killed if found away from their place of employment before the date on their bracelet. So, and then they were housed in barracks or housing. They were not living with the white. So you see outside of each town, the white town and then the black township, just like South Africa. So, are there more things you're wondering?
Well, is Namibia considered South Africa, or is it too far north?
Well, it's right next to South Africa,
it's
and
next to it, but it's
clearly by or? When South Africa accepted it at the time, at the end of the First World War, they had every intention of incorporating it mm-hmm. as another province of South Africa. So, but this is a separate, you know, it's a separate country. And that is what the battle has raged now over the last quarter century, is its separateness from South Africa. But originally, I mean, clearly all the way along, South Africa has tried to govern it as though it were a part of their country. Are there other...
Well, you'll probably cover this, but I'm leaving today, and I want to know now what's happening right now. Would you mind?
Well, sure. Let me just say real briefly that right now Namibia is, as since March 21st this year, independent, an independent country.
But is it really?
It's independent politically. It is still very, very dependent economically on South Africa. And so, to jump way ahead, there is a great deal of work to be done to develop a nation, to build a nation really out of the rubble that is left after an experience like this. Because, for example, the contract labor system destroyed the families of the Namibian people. I mean, it's a tremendous loss. The rate of alcoholism, the rate of mental illness, unemployment, illiteracy, you name it. It's a massive, massive problem. Yes?
It strikes me that Namibia is... struggle for independence has been so long, and yet it doesn't seem like it's got nearly the attention as other struggles for independence.
I used to feel it was South Africa's best kept secret was Namibia, because they did not want any kind of world attention to Namibia. Maybe one reason that it did not demand attention was the population size. Because, it's clearly always been on the back burner, if it's on the stove at all, in terms of attention. Yes?
Hasn't there been a United Nations mandate since the mid-60s?
Yeah, right. And that's what we're coming to. Now, this session I was going to get us up to the early 60s, and then... Oh goodness, we got to speed this up. Well, let me skip over and just talk a little bit about the significance of the 60s, 59-60, for Namibia. The contract labor system and the system of separate housing, the township system, certainly gave rise to, and the suffering, the starvation. I mean, in a country of this wealth, nearly one child in five was dying of malnutrition by the age of five. I mean, it isn't like Somalia or Ethiopia, where they've had terrible, terrible situations of drought and lack of resources. It's full of resources. So this, of course, the resistance to South Africa, South Africa's occupation has continued all the way. In the 1950s, there began to be education organization among laborers, and that this contract labor system, one of the things it does is put a whole bunch of people together in very bad situation. And of course, not being dumb, Namibians used this time to think about how are we going to change the system. And in the late 1950s, a man named Toivo Yatoivo, who was working not in Namibia but contract labor or in the fisheries way down in Cape Town, formed what he called the Ovambo People's Organization, he being from Ovamboland. And then as a means of starting to organize to change the system. In 1959, in December, out in Windhoek, which is the capital, the government did a forced removal of all blacks. The black location, as it was called, was unfortunately on a nice piece of land. It was a kind of a hill. It was a beautiful spot. There was even a little water there, and would make a wonderful white suburb, it was realized. And so in 1959 came this forced removal of all the blacks from what they call the old location. And the blacks, you know, South Africa designates blacks or coloreds. The so-called coloreds were moved to one new location, Kommersdal, outside the city. The blacks were moved to a place that they named Katatura, which means this is not our home, or alternately, we will never stay here. The old people were taken by the truckload out to these barren reservations. And you know, I've talked to younger Namibians who remember seeing their grandparents hauled off in the trucks. So there was tremendous protest in December of 59, a number of people killed, but that seemed to be the catalytic agent for the forming of SWAPO, the Southwest Africa People's Organization. And that group has led the battle for independence both politically and militarily. But there's been another force in Namibia which makes Namibia's liberation struggle a very unique one, and that is the church. Because it was the church which had played, you know, such a negative role, elected its first black bishop, Bishop Owala, whom I'm sure you met on many occasions. That happened also. The first black bishop of the church in the north, Leonard Owala, was elected in 1960. And as more and more blacks took control, took leadership positions in the church, the church's view of the struggle changed until really it has been the church and the Lutheran church that has played a leading role. In 1966, the UN declared that South Africa had violated the trust and ordered them out of Namibia. Of course, they didn't leave. In 1971, the World Court of Justice ruled that their presence there in Namibia was illegal. They must withdraw immediately. They didn't leave, but they had this idea. They rejected the World Court opinion, and then they contacted Bishop Owala because they were sure that this man, this black Namibian, would do what they wanted. They wanted him to vindicate their stand, that they wanted him to say, no, we want South Africa here. And he said, well, let me meet with some of my boards before I make any statement. And he met with his church boards. He met with the students and the instructors at the Lutheran Seminary, Paulinum. And out of that came what has been called the open letter.
This is in 1971. It was an open letter written by Bishop Awala and some of the other theologians to the South African government, quoting the international human rights, saying that what South Africa is doing basically is in not only in violation of our human rights, it is contrary to the gospel. And this open letter was read from every pulpit in Namibia. And I have Namibian friends who said the whole country changed in one day. Because here was church leadership saying this that we have felt was so wrong and so unjust is contrary to the gospel. And it was an absolutely electrifying moment in history. And from then on, from 71, there was really no turning back in terms of the commitment of the Namibian church to be the spokesperson for the Namibian people in their struggle for independence. Well, they called them in, the two signers, but they didn't back down. And certainly, there was very little, I guess, that South Africa felt they could do to a man with the stature of Bishop Awala. He was, you know, 500,000 Ovambo. He was their spiritual leader, and that gave him a certain immunity. But, yes?
Was SWAPO a group that followed the same sort of philosophy as the ANC as far as the use of violent means?
SWAPO started out as political party. Now, the ANC went, what, 50 years of nonviolence. Mm-hmm. SWAPO went 6 years, from 1960 to 1966. And then in 1966, there was a... they were hoping that the World Court at that time would say South Africa had to leave. One of the things that has amazed me with the Namibian people is their confidence that the World Court will act in a just manner, and or that the United States will act in a just manner, or I have never seen such confidence. And so they thought in 1966, this is going to be over because the World Court will say South Africa has to leave, and they'll leave. But at that time, the World Court didn't rule on the issue. They just said it has been brought improperly. You know, it was a technicality. They dismissed the case. And the Namibians said, we will have to bring our own liberation. We will fight. And so they began the armed struggle in 66.
How did that affect its relationship with the Lutheran Church? What kind of relationship has there been between SWAPO and
there's been a very close relationship between SWAPO and the Lutheran Church. Bishop Dumeni says SWAPO is our children. While the leaders of the church have certainly stuck to the end with their feelings about this must be a nonviolent struggle, Bishop Dumeni says, we cannot condemn those who feel there is no other way and who have taken up arms. One of the leading theologians, and we'll get back to this tomorrow, Zephaniah Kameta, who is a Lutheran theologian in Namibia, was for a number of years a SWAPO vice president. Now he is in the parliament. Now he's been elected deputy speaker. And so he is now going to resign his position as deputy bishop in the church. But while there has been a separation, I mean, the Lutherans were sometimes, or the Council of Churches sometimes accused of being the church arm of SWAPO. They have tried to maintain a separation, but there has certainly been very close ties between the church and SWAPO. Well, I don't know whether it's time to quit. I had thought that the next session we would go over the UN, SWAPO, the role of the church, and liberation. So those of you who are still here, come on back.